This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This episode is brought to you by us, Loz and Lou, as we have now released our go-to guides. And if you've loved what we've created here, then hit that subscribe button and make a purchase of a go-to guide to make sure that you're set up for success for a return to paid work.
You can shop our go-to guides now at readyornot.au.
Owe these companies our bodies or our lives? I know that some people have experiences where their boss is mad at them for having a baby. Unfortunately, our social systems are not set up to thank you for your sacrifice. I think we're so raised to feel like love in motherhood is meant to be sacrifice. When we started measuring GDP, like a bunch of white men decided not to include caring or housework in that. So I think the biggest piece of the puzzle is actually dads. I just think if you're in a heterosexual relationship, it's so easy to direct that rage at the representation of the patriarchy that's in your home. I think that being an involved dad right now is the same as being a working mum in the 90s. It's not like you're the only one, but we're like, that's a bit weird.
Ellen Hooper is a people and culture expert. She's a passionate speaker and media commentator, and she's currently writing a book about parenting. She's been interviewing a lot of dads. In fact, she's become a bit obsessed with them and their voice and opinions in the conversation of how we rebalance the mental load of parenting. She's full to the brim with incredible advice and lived experience when it comes to career and motherhood and 50-50 parenting. And she's deeply passionate in educating mothers on doing the maths when it comes to their paid work, their superannuation, and their overall financial security. Here, we talk about the research that flies in the face of the gender norms often associated with parenting, her morbid but important advice for looking at how we view care work and housework, and what she's learned from interviewing the dads. I'm Lucinda, this is Ready or Not, and here is the wise and whip smart, Ellen Hooper.
Ellen, I've heard you share some incredible facts, science-backed, which we love, about the amygdala. I knew I wouldn't be able to say that word. I can never get that word out. And secondly, about oxytocin. And these facts totally fly in the face of the gender norms we've been told about parenting. And I'd love for you to share them with us, please.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't remember the scientist who did the research. So that's already bothering me. There's this great documentary on Netflix called Babies. It's a four-parter. And the first episode is called Love. And they went through a whole range of research that people had done with babies. And unsurprisingly, like, we don't know that much about babies because they can't tell us anything. But this really amazing research that I've been really fascinated with shows us that dads, or who spend lots of a physical contact with newborns, had the same level of oxytocin as mums who have like grown and give birth to newborns have. So it's really fascinating. Like, there's no kind of obvious biological reason for that. Like, most people listening here will probably know a bit about oxytocin through pregnancy and birth, that kind of like the love hormone. I'm not a scientist or a biologist, so I'm a people and culture expert, but I just thought that research was so fascinating. And then they kind of took it that step further and did some, the same team did research with gay male couples who had their babies from birth. And they actually found that the brain scans they did of the dads who had become the primary parent, the amygdala, so the part of your brain, their part of their brains, looked exactly the same for those dads as for mums who had given birth to babies as well. So I just think that research is so fascinating, and it articulates something that I have believed, which is biology doesn't really care, you know, if you're a man or a woman. It's so cool that the body actually goes, well, if you want to be a committed caregiver, and I really love that language, if you want to be a committed caregiver, like, that's cool, like, we're going to go with it. And I think that's so useful because in the type of work that I do, and I'm researching and writing a book about working parents at the moment, I just get so, I have so many kind of barbecue conversations about biology, which I'm not an expert in, but just kind of like, oh, well, that's just like women are really good at that stuff. And, oh, men are like not great at that stuff, or it's harder for them, or so it's, that's a really cool kind of piece of research that's showing us that that's not actually true.
I love that. I find that so fascinating. And we will get to your book, but before we do, take me back to the Ellen pre-kids. What did her career look like?
Yeah, so I started my career as a lawyer and I really enjoyed it for a couple of years because I really love learning and it was a really interesting team environment. It's kind of quite a collaborative job as a junior. Everyone was very smart and interesting, like there were really great people to work with. And then if I'd done any personality testing, so what used to happen is I worked for a global corporate law firm. They invested heaps in professional development training, which was amazing. I learned so much there. It's probably one of the reasons why I pivoted my career into training. But they used to use the Myers-Briggs methodology. So you can go and do a free quiz online to see your personality type there. And at the start of every training, they would put like the four boxes up on a like flip chart. And I was always alone. Like I was always the like extrovert who had lots of feelings in this like, you know, environment with high introversion, high thinking, like rational thought profile. It's quite interesting because I was a good lawyer. I quite liked the practice of law in some ways, but there's something about being so kind of countercultural to the way that the profession works. And I found myself honestly crying in my office for about 3 months. And so I'm slowly like made the move into HR. I think we kind of tell our career stories in these like boom, boom, boom. And it looks like people often say to me, oh my gosh, how did you make this amazing change, you know, from being a lawyer to now running a coaching and training business? And I think we forget it took 10 years.
Yeah.
Like it took 10 years of deliberate action and it took 10 years of the next best thing. Like when I was a lawyer in private practice, I was desperate to move into HR. I would have applied for 30 jobs. I got zero interviews, you know, and I ended up moving into an in-house law role at the Department of Education, which I really loved. But I was disappointed by that move. And it worked incredibly well because I had a really supported experience there. That's where I moved into HR. You know, the internal moves are often the easier ones. But yeah, at the time I was truly bummed out about it. And I think that's just helpful for people who are like job searching's hard. It's really tough. It's just really important for us to like be real about that it wasn't easy, that it involved persistence. And
speaking of persistence, you're watching me feed and still managing to talk. So well done for that. And I'm sorry that I have to look down every now and then.
You're doing so well.
But I want to know, when did thinking about a family enter the picture for you? Did it worry you throughout your 20s, or were you that sort of person that didn't really think about it until they did?
I have been worried about having children since I was a teenager.
Same.
Yeah. Isn't that sad and funny? Yeah. And I think the reason I was worried about it was because I think it was something I always knew I wanted to do. But then I was like, well, how the fuck does that work? You know, I was born in the 80s and I had a dad who worked and earned lots of money and a mum who was at home. I mean, my mum was the president of every committee of every institution I've ever engaged in. So she, you know, I always say like I learned so much about leadership from her.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I forgot my like school hat, she would go and get it. Like that's just a real, I remember before my son started school being like really stressed about after school care. Cause when we were kids after school care, my memories of like the three times in my life I went to after school care were like, I mean, traumatic's too hard, it's too big, but I remember hating it. And I think at that stage in, you know, where we were socially, like it was an unusual thing for kids. Oh, that was my like a very limited perspective. And of course my kid, so we got a nanny for to help us for some of the pickups in the first year of prep, and my kid was always like, I want to go to after school care. Like,
isn't that funny,
nanny?
I was about to say, because I was in the privileged position of not having to go to after school care because my mum was also around, I actually wanted to go to after school care but I wonder what my relationship with it would have been if there was no choice involved at all. So that's really interesting.
Claire Andrews, who runs Safe Hands Parenting, talks about like we come into parenting with our little backpacks filled with, you know, our history. So, and I've definitely talked to, you know, mums at school who were always the last kids at after school care. And that's been a big part of why they've taken longer off work than I have, for example. And so Claire talks about, you know, ideally before you have a baby, but I think lots of people do it while they have a baby. You got to unpack your backpacks.
That is such an interesting analogy.
What are we keeping and what are we throwing away? I mean, easier said than done, but that's a big part of it.
So you're like me, someone that always wrestled with how motherhood and career were going to work. Then I guess the conversation starts to get a bit more real about having kids. Where are you at career-wise then? And how are you feeling about it when push is starting to come to shove?
My husband wanted to have kids earlier than I did. And I think that makes a pretty different conversation than a lot of couples are having. And of course, he's still a lawyer. And his first love is law. And so we, you know, had these two like young trained lawyers in their 20s, like we negotiated really hard. And so, you know, that there was a lot of things that we agreed to before even trying to have children. And I wish more people did that. I think it was really useful because it was a much better way to have that conversation. I think it's, I mean, you have that conversation, I think, for the rest of your life, to be honest. But we definitely went into parenting with like a shared understanding about what was important to us. And so there were some things that we had agreed on. Like I took 9 months off with both kids and my husband took 3 months off, like the 9 to 12 month mark. And that gets such a game changer, just an incredible game changer for us. And I don't think we have a primary parent in our house. Our kids don't act like there's a primary parent. They're smart, so they will choose who they make certain requests to because they have a good read on us. But we still have our thing on the fridge about, you know, we do half the drop off and pickups each. And there was a lot of things that my husband kind of took carriage of. Sorry, I sound like such a lawyer. that my husband was in charge of because he did that 9 to 12 month mark. So he took over all the maternal child health appointments, and then that turned into, you know, then they say, well, you got to take the kids to the dentist. So then he takes the kids to the dentist and he enrolled them for school and childcare. And so he's the first number that they call. Now, we've now been across kind of 4 different childcares and schools just because we moved house and 2 kids. And this is now the first place that ever actually calls him first. Isn't that crazy? He's always first on the form, but for 3 other places they still always called me.
Yes, of course. It's so typical.
Yeah. So it's tricky where your kind of individual's desires of how you want to parent and how you want to work together, like they just come up against the kind of system that we work in.
That's so interesting that you say that. My husband, Posey's now 9 weeks old, and I've only done 1 pickup and 1 drop off of our older son in that time, but I still get the call. And I'm like, you haven't seen my face in 2 months, basically. Why are you calling me? I know I'm first on the form, but you've seen my husband in there day in, day out, 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And it's quite fascinating.
I do something that my friends think is psychotic, but maybe some listeners will find it useful. I always screen childcare calls.
Yeah.
Just because you leave me a voicemail and then I'll know if it's stupid or real.
I pretty much screen a call from any number that doesn't immediately become familiar to me. So I pretty much do that by accident anyway. So I get that. And if it's an emergency, you'll find out quick enough.
I listen to the voicemail. Like I'm not crazy.
Yeah. No, I get that. It's changing habits. How else do you do it?
Totally. Yeah.
A question I did want to ask you, which I'll get to now because you've led me there beautifully, is that you're really interested now in talking about rebalancing the mental load and how we parent more equally. Do you think, obviously you've learned a lot with hindsight, but do you think that pre-pregnancy with your first child, you were already privier to that than other people perhaps?
I think there were 2 things that women told me, that other women told me, that I was really scared about. I think it was more about that than the mental load. So, and those 2 things were, you will become a completely different person and everything that you care about will change. And I was like, well, I don't want that.
Like, that's terrifying.
That sounds really bad. And also kind of, you know, oh, and you will need to work part-time. or you'll need flexibility. And I firstly, I just want to say, I know that both those things are really true experiences for lots of people. And I think that those are actually some things that men experience too. So I was much more concerned about that. And so my big thing was like, no, I really want to work. And I don't know why I really wanted to work full time. And I have worked full time for the majority of the kids' lives. And when I've worked part time, I found it excruciating. I found it so hard.
Was that because it was harder to balance different roles, or is it because you just felt like you never had enough hours in the day for your work? What was hard about that, do you think?
I think that it's really possible to design work to be part time because all work is made up actually, and all jobs, you know, having done a lot of work of like designing organizational structures, all jobs are actually just discretionary. Like we put a bunch of post-its on a wall and we clump things together. And the 5-day work week is a social construct too. So like all of these things are genuinely theoretical. And I don't think corporate Australia is showing any capability in designing work to be part-time. So it was mostly this like feeling of like the square peg in the round hole more than anything else. I've job shared an executive role, which was really great. And so I did that so that I could also run my business. So I've always worked full-time, just I've done a few things in different ways.
Yeah.
And the thing that I found hard about that wasn't necessarily part-time work. It was the kind of being deeply invested in two different businesses at the same time. So that kind of just like mental switching.
And then there's the business of running a household and a family with your partner.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other entity in and of itself, which requires probably more mental work than any paid role ever does. So I'm to-ing and fro-ing a bit with you, but I want to know, you do then fall pregnant. Where are you at in that stage of life? And how does pregnancy go alongside paid work for you?
So badly.
Oh, no.
I really struggled with pregnancy. I had really 24/7 nausea.
Oh,
I also never vomited. So, of course, I put on a kilo a week. I'm gluten-free and I just ate bread and Red Rooster for like the first trimester. Because I had been moving from law into HR, we very deliberately made the decision of, okay, because I was still looking for a new job because I was keen to kind of keep moving further into HR. I also really believe that whichever job I had when I had a baby, like I felt like I would be frozen in time.
I know exactly that feeling. It's like, how could you possibly move afterwards? Like that's it. You need to get your ducks lined up to that point and then life will never change again in the workforce.
I just couldn't have been more wrong about that. And I just really do want to tell people who are thinking about having babies, who are pregnant, who have little babies, you know, like since my son is 7, I've had 3 different jobs since then, like got promoted twice, started 2 businesses, you know, like and you don't have to do that stuff either. Like, but so I was obsessed with getting a management role. I was like, I must.
It felt like a line in the sand. It felt like a finish line.
Yeah, it was misguided. So we started trying to have a baby and then, and I was looking and I was applying for jobs at the same time because my experience was that lots of people, it took a long time to get pregnant and it takes a long time to get a job. And I do still think that if you're up for it, that treating those as 2 parallel lines and kind of pursuing them both is something that people don't consider enough. It's not for everyone. And I think it depends on how, I guess, like your relationship to change and how much you like variety and, you know, how you feel about agility and things like that. But it worked pretty well for me. And then, of course, we were very lucky but also shocked to get pregnant straight away, which is, of course, the same week I got offered a new job.
It always happens at the same time.
And I took that new job and it was really, really good. The good things about it were I got to like reestablish the expectations on me. So I got to kind of go at my own pace because I had never known me to go at any other. I felt like I was moving like glacially. But they were just like, oh, yeah, this is fine.
You're like, is it fun?
Yeah, they're like, good job.
Very slow.
Good job. Yeah. And so, yeah, that actually worked really, really well for me. But I found pregnancy to be really difficult.
Physically taxing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're sick the whole time, then of course.
Just like insane nausea into pelvic instability, into heartburn. Like, you know, fun times.
Not fun. Before we move on, though, I do want to ask you, because I am the personality type that would be petrified of telling a new workplace that I was pregnant. And I don't know why, because I think that...
No, that's very fair.
Mothers should absolutely go for those opportunities, but I personally would not handle it well. My witching hour co-host, Loz, would handle it fine. I think you would have handled it well. How did you approach that? How did you navigate those conversations? How did you feel about it?
I just always want to acknowledge that I have a career in HR. So this particular organization was literally hiring me to lead their team on HR compliance. So that's not the person that you discriminate against. So Don't fuck with me. they just wouldn't have, you know, like that. I go in with so much cover. So I just think that's really important. But I think the other thing is, like, we don't owe these companies our, like, bodies or our lives. And I know that some people have experiences where they're like, boss is mad at them for having a baby. And that's a bad boss. Like, that's no good.
That's a very bad boss.
So I think there's something to weigh up in those decisions. The thing is, I think this is about knowing yourself really well, and the opportunity is yours. You are, I'm going to actually say, like, you're entitled to it and you don't owe them anything. So if you want to take that opportunity, there's a reason that you're scared of doing those things. And that's because we have histories and histories of being treated poorly and discriminated against. So it's an unfortunate but rational thing to be worried about. So if you want to go in there and take that opportunity and know that it belongs to you and back yourself, they can find out whenever you're ready to tell them and you don't owe them anything. If you are, like, kind of juggling about the place that you're currently at and you've got some really good things about that place and you want to test how your employer is actually going to be about the fact that you are pregnant and how supportive they're going to be, then yeah, I would tell them at offer stage and I would judge them on their response. And I think that's really fair as well.
And so how did you go into those conversations? How far along were you? All of those things.
I was in the first trimester. I think I was 8 weeks pregnant. I just, like, always look pregnant immediately.
And if you're feeling that bad, it's pretty hard to avoid the conversation, isn't it?
Being really sick was a big part of it. I wanted to know what they would be like. And they were great, like, also public sector. They called it back being like, we just want you to know, like, you actually won't qualify for parental leave. Like, they were really worried about my finance. And I was like, yeah, I know that because that's my specialty, but thank you. You know, they were just like really, they were really caring about it. My recommendation is always wait to get an offer till you negotiate anything. Flexibility and part-time work, I think, is becoming more and more, people more and more open to negotiating that early in the process. But I just think it's a classic negotiating leverage technique. Like, wait, if they really want you, like, if they have chosen you amongst a sea of many other people, like, be their preferred candidate. You'll have the most leverage. You'll have the least risk that there's kind of either conscious or unconscious biases going into a process and then negotiate hard.
Yeah.
So that's always what I recommend. Which is, like, a bit skeptical and cynical, but I feel like the evidence backs me up on that.
Well, we've got to look after ourselves, unfortunately, don't we? In a system that doesn't always look after us.
Yeah.
So then you're someone that loves work but always wanted to be a mum. How does someone of that nature plan for maternity leave? Are you excited? Are you nervous? Are you both?
I have a theory that maternity leave is really great for you if you're introverted and spontaneous, and I'm a very planned extrovert. I just went out with some friends last night, and one of our friends is having her second baby, and we were laughing because, you know, I feel like there's often someone you spend your parental leave with. You know, I have a really good friend. She's close to me. That our kids are 3 weeks apart. We were like family. We spend so much time together. I saw her way more than I saw my husband in that year. And when I was pregnant with my daughter, I was like, I'm really going to enjoy this parental. Like, I think I'm going to really like it. I'm going to take the whole 12 months off this time. Like, I'm just going to really enjoy it. And she was kind of like, you won't though. She was like, I've seen you.
Yeah.
This isn't for you. Like, that's nice that you are giving
good
it a
intentions.
Crack. Yeah. I didn't really, I'm prepared for everything, but I didn't really prepare for that period of time because I just think it's unplannable. There's just too many variables. But it was always important to me to like quickly gather a crew. I spent a lot of time with my parents' groups and other mums, and like that period of my life, like online Facebook communities were really important and useful to me. And my husband took the first 6 weeks off. So that was really great to kind of like, work that out together. It was really, really great. Mm. Some friends, because I've been interviewing lots of parents, but some friends of mine have their theory is like the best time to take if your partner is going to take an extended period of leave, do it in the first 3 months. So take the first 3 months off together, like assuming that's the amount of, lots of men are leaving money on the table with parental leave.
Yeah.
Because their view is that like, okay, everyone gets expert in the baby. And so then for the next 12 months, you have, you know where stuff is and you have shared language and you have all of those things together. So,
and you also appreciate what happens in the day to day of after a baby.
I actually preferred the divide and conquer because I felt like I kind of got more of myself and more to myself. But it's just good to know there's heaps of different ways to do it.
And so you took about 9 months off for both of your children.
I am with my second kid.
Not with your second?
No, I was like, I'm going to take 12 months. And then at 8 months, I called my boss and I was like,
Can I come back? And so at that point, your husband takes over primary roles for 3 months.
Yeah.
And you say that if you look at that specific window, it makes no financial sense. But if you looked at the broader picture, it meant greater earning capacity for you as you've moved through your career.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah. So here's my theory. Well, there's little bits of evidence and research in it. I haven't like written a PhD on this specifically. But my theory is that like, there tends to be an age gap between men and women. So my husband's 3 years older than me. And then at the time that you're thinking about kids, like let's say that it's 30 and 33, we were a bit younger than that. But like 3 years of work is a huge difference in salary.
Especially at that stage of your life when you put it like that.
Yeah.
Like if you're 60, it might not mean as much. But in your 30s, you've only been around for 10, 15 years.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and particularly if you have a professional role, so you've like probably uni's probably like spat you out like 25, you know, you haven't been working for that long and there's a gender wage gap and all of those things. So you tend to have this earning gap at that stage. So at that time, my husband earned significantly more than me. He was a barrister, so he had no leave entitlements.
Mm.
So it was like, it was the accountants would have been like, don't do that. But what it meant was my transition back to work was great. I actually started another new job.
Let's throw this in.
Yeah.
Let's start fresh.
Yeah. And that was because, you know, like a headhunter called while I was on parental leave. And I just, the fact that I knew that like my husband had it meant that I was like, I can start a new job. So that was like already, you know, there was already a salary bump with that. And it meant that my return to work and my kids' start at childcare were actually two different things. And I think for a lot of people they're at the same time. And
which is so much to take on.
And having then gone back to work for 3 months and then started a kid at childcare, even with like this kind of husband, that was so rough. Like the transition to childcare was so hard. And I remember thinking, if we'd done that together, if we'd done those two things at the same time, I would have really doubted my return to work. And I see that play out so much. Like I mustn't be doing the right thing because this is hard on my kid. You know, they're tired. They're
taking a lot of sick leave.
Yeah, everyone's sick. Yeah, that's how we manage that. And then because I then went back full-time, part-time, doesn't really matter, but went back in this really supported way where I wasn't running our household and working. We both had jobs. Dr. Robin Miller, who's an expert in the mental load, her big tip is divide, don't delegate. So we had really clear divisions about who did what and which drop off and pick up days. you know, I've always worked in this really supported way, and I just know that's not available to all women. But that has meant that my salary has probably, like, it's doubled.
Yeah.
In that 7 years. Now, that won't be everyone's experience, like, of course.
But we do hone in on those early days, oh, don't we? Yeah. It's even that conversation. Don't even get me started on the fact that most mums compare childcare costs to their salary alone, because that just makes no sense to me. But even just the idea of how much childcare costs in that small amount of time, but then they get to primary school, which is close to free. We don't look at it from that bigger picture of then what it does for earning capacity over a greater amount of time.
Yeah. And that was like, that was my parents' conversation, you know. Well, my mom says, we did the maths. And every time I do a podcast, she's like, we thought we were doing the right thing. And I was like, I know. I love you, mom. The equation that we tell people actually isn't sensible. So the equation they did, which lots of couples are still doing, by the time I, woman, go back to work, and we pay childcare out of my salary because for some reason childcare is only a woman's expense, which is stupid. And then I pay tax, I'm earning like $10, you know, it's or $10,000 or something like that. So therefore it's not worth it. And I just really encourage everyone to do the maths over a 5-year period and or a 50-year period, because, you know, just taking that period of time off. Firstly, you're not diversifying your family's income. So, like, money's important. It's like a part of, you know, our health and well-being and financial security. So if you've got one person working, one person who's not, you're not, like, that's high risk for a range of reasons. Like, maybe they want to become a music teacher at some point, not just, like, tragic circumstances, which are all they have.
Yes, of course.
My book coach was like, Ellen, you talk about death a lot. And I was like, what? Is that weird? Even if you do want to think about it as being a cost that belongs to a woman and you do want to think about tax, just, you know, superannuation compounds. And so the money you don't put in this year, it costs you a lot in the future. And we were talking about this before, but Melissa Brown has a free calculator on her website. She's a financial expert, personal finance expert, where you can kind of calculate your, like, lost salary. So if you take a year off or 2 years off or 3 years off at your salary and see what that looks like, you know, by the time you're 50 or 60. And it's massive. It's like hundreds of thousands of dollars that you're missing out on in your super. And we know that women have significantly less superannuation than men. And so then we've also got this really alarming statistic that women in their 60s are like the rising group of being at risk of homelessness. So
that was jarring when I read that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, our social systems are not set up to thank you for your sacrifice. And there's something else that's really interesting, which is I think we're so raised to feel like love, like motherhood. Love in motherhood is meant to be sacrifice.
Yes.
I just see that what that brings out in us is like resentment.
Mm.
And then the things that we like to use as the things that we like to use when we feel resentment is then guilt.
Yes.
If you focused on love as joy rather than love as sacrifice, I just think it's interesting to think what could change.
Yes. And to go from joy to death.
To death.
You have a really great tip that, as you say, is pretty morbid, but I think really important. Give it to us.
My husband really loves this one. So I think sometimes, like all good things, like all good tools I use, this like came from a marital fight. So I think there's this dynamic that often plays out because, you know, if you stay at home with the baby for the most hours, you get the PhD in the baby and then you like you're the expert. And then we can actually be pretty critical about other people engaging with the baby in the wrong way. And so that kind of breeds a dynamic. But then the thing that starts to happen, because I have lots of opinions about what's right and wrong, and maybe I don't say them, but my great poker face obviously conveys them. So then you have this dynamic where everyone wants to ask you like 1,000 questions.
Yeah.
Like, should I pack a hat? Do they need a jumper? Like, just, you know, like, well, you're an adult who knows how to get dressed. Like, I'm sure you've got this.
Can you see the sun out?
Yep,
yeah. Yeah. Pack a hat. My husband does this to me quite a bit still, and we're really even parents, but he still wants my opinion on things. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, and I think there's something for that in us, which is like, are we critical? You know, how do we respond when someone does something that is not exactly how we would have done it?
So true.
But I think it was the jumper. I think it was, does he need a jumper? And I just looked at him because I'm a psycho. And I was like, well, what would you do if I was dead? And now that's like, just stay with me, guys. That's actually a really good technique for working out, like, if something belongs to you or not, like, and particularly expenses, like, is this a family expense or is this a me expense? So childcare is that classic thing of like, well, if I wasn't here for whatever reason, my husband would pay for childcare.
Yeah.
It's a bit jarring, but I think that's useful because I think it helps us, like, I think really question our assumptions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just... I'm sorry for anyone who has anxiety or catastrophic thoughts if I've spiraled you out, but it's just this thing of like, how do we build a family that functions like where everyone has a role to play?
Yeah. It sort of puts more value on the work everyone's doing too, because then if a dad, and say it was less morbid, say the parents split up and the child is in care of the mum 1 week or the primary caregiver 1 week, and then the other mum or the dad or whoever it is that other week, that's the same situation. It's okay, well, you still have to figure out what care is happening for that child that week. And then it assigns value to that role as opposed to just being a given that the primary caregiver does it. It's like, oh, that costs money. And I hate to be so capitalist in that way because we often, unfortunately, assign things that cost money to being of value. But I guess it redistributes this idea that it should just fall on that mum and says, oh no, this is something that actually needs to be looked at from a bigger picture.
Yeah, and there's a really very valid and useful kind of debate about, or I guess knowing that women's work has historically just been undervalued, or caring work. I want to say caring work hasn't been properly valued. Like if you, there's definitely research by some US economists and some New Zealand economists about if you have to replace all the things that stay-at-home parents did, or if you were to pay them like a basic wage for their hours, like we're talking about over $100,000, like closer to $200,000 in terms of value. And I think that's really, really important. But I'm also a pragmatist in like, well, we unfortunately don't live in a world that works like that at the moment. And kind of the reason for that goes back to the 1800s when we started measuring gross domestic product, because I'm also not an economist, but when we started measuring GDP, like a bunch of white men decided not to include
caregiving,
caring or like housework in that. So, you know, then we don't think about that in terms of our economy either. So it's just this kind of constant back and forth about what do I want to do as an individual, and then how can I keep nudging these systems that are not set up well. And, you know, I think the biggest piece of the puzzle is actually dads. Like I've become obsessed with dads.
It's interesting you say that. Another brilliant segue, by the way, but it's interesting that you say that because in my however many interviews I've done now, must be over 60, with mothers who are engaged in paid work, one of my biggest reflections has been we can make workplaces better for the mums all that we want, but we're missing such a bigger part of the picture, and that is that you're then still saying that ultimately most of the parenting should fall on the mum and she needs to find a way to make it work within more supportive systems. If we support dads at work, that helps mums probably more than supporting mums at work in a lot of instances, because we're saying that we value them as parents, not just as providers.
Yeah, and I'm really worried that we've shut dads out of parenting spaces. So lots of dads I talk to say the maternal child health nurse was really suspicious that I was there.
Yes.
That I go to the playground and nobody talks to me.
Fiona Kalacki literally just said this on the podcast that has gone out today. She said that all the mums in the playground thought that her husband was hitting on them, because how could a dad just be there parenting?
Yeah, that's truly fucked. So my personal view, I think there's so much reason to feel rage.
Yeah.
And I think it's so interesting, you know, how can we kind of feel our rage at the system without I mean, I just think if you're in a heterosexual relationship, it's so easy to direct that rage at like the representation of the patriarchy that's in your home. And that is quite unfair, you know, and I say that not with kind of judgment or criticism, but as someone who's gone on that journey.
Yeah.
And the reason why I've become obsessed with dads is like, sorry, that doesn't always sound so groupy. I'm just so sick of screaming into the void. Like I'm bored's not the right word. I'm kind of sick of just describing the problem over and over again. Like I want to see change. And when I kind of work out what change needs to look like, you know, I'm really concerned that dads are like 300% more likely to have their flexible work requests denied, that like ballet schools tell dads they can't come backstage with their kids. Like there's just so, yeah, I think it's like, how do we bring dads into the picture? And I've talked to heaps of dads now. It's really interesting. The difference between the dad who says he wants to be involved, I've been calling them involved dads. I don't really know how to describe it yet. And then the dad who actually does.
Yeah.
So far, you know, with my like great sample size of, I mean, I've probably interviewed like 30 dads. I think the theme is that the dads who actually do it just don't give a fuck about what other people think.
Yeah.
Because when I say to them, oh, you know, is your workplace supportive? They're kind of like, not really.
It's interesting that you say that because I was going to ask what your husband's experience was, because law is a pretty backward industry, I'd say, in a lot of ways. Maybe not so much now, but I mean, historically, I picture a whole lot of old men sitting up there in their, I don't even know what you call where they sit.
It's very worrying that group of people is in charge of justice. I think there's two things about it. I think he's definitely an outlier. And I think that some of his colleagues are just like a bit, they're either fascinated or perplexed by him.
Yes.
And we went to a dancing for my son the other day and we ran into like another barrister there and, you know, his wife said to me like, oh, you know, because they just can't do drop-offs and pick-ups.
You're like, yeah.
Yeah. It's like,
How do I approach this one?
Oh, yeah, I know. And then I always come home really furious.
Yeah.
I think that being an involved dad right now is the same as being a working mom in the 90s. It's not like you're the only one, but we're like, that's a bit weird, just like as a society. And then I think that people who are exceptional, I think they get a lot of leeway. And my husband will hate this, but my husband's exceptional. Like he's a valedictorian of our law school. Like he's incredible at what he does. And he doesn't care what other people think. I also think he probably keeps his caregiving to himself a bit because you get to do that when you're not visibly like pregnant.
Yeah.
I suspect that when he took 3 months off, there were some people he would happily share that with, and there are some people where he was like, no, I'm not available at the moment for that trial, because you get to do that. Dads who want to really partner equally, like they have to be countercultural and they get a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So let's go on to your book then. I've got two more questions for you because we are running out of time. So you are interviewing a lot of dads, as you say. Firstly, tell us about your book and why you're interviewing dads.
I'm really interested in this idea of what I know as an expert in adult learning, like how do we learn and how we can apply that to our lives. Like I'm an executive coach. I coach a lot of senior leaders and I've just found that the challenges women face aren't really at work. So I never thought I'd be like obsessed with and become like an expert in like how people divide like their washing and cooking. But that seems to be like where the problem needs to be solved. And so I'm really interested in that. Like, how can we be the equal parents that we want to be without hating each other?
Mm.
Yeah, that's what I've been writing about. I don't have a publisher yet. So if anyone's in publishing and wants to reach out, that'd be great. It just lives so much in my brain that I just had to start kind of getting it out.
And so then secondly, we've talked about that the real present dads, and again, I can't think of a better term for that either yet, but those genuinely interested in parenting evenly dads.
Yeah.
one of the key themes is that they just don't give a fuck what other people think. What are some other key themes that you've noticed from chatting to those types of dads?
That their motivations are all different. So I've been asking dads, what kind of dad do you want to be and why? And that's been really interesting. And so some people want to be an involved dad because of the way that their dad was kind of around and they want to do it differently, or their dad was really around and they want to do it the same. One dad I spoke to was like, I think that when you look at all marital tension in like later in life, it all comes back to like resentments from this time of young children, that like,
if only all dads were that wise.
Yep. And some dads are just like, I believe in fairness and equality. And some dads like, I don't know, I just do.
Do many of them mention their wives in heterosexual relationships?
Of course. And I think there's an element of, this is my wife's expectation of her life. And I was laughing with a friend who I interviewed who was like so articulate about it, and like it was so articulate about equality and why it was important and why his marriage was important to him. And then when we finished, I was like, it's so funny you never have mentioned the word love. but that was it. Like, that was actually the driver. I was like, well, I love these kids and I love my wife. And
yeah.
And, you know, there's some really interesting research that by the age of 7, girls can articulate a range of emotions and boys can talk about happy and sad. Now, that's old research. I'm sure it would be different today because of the amount of emotional literacy that kids do in school, which I sometimes tear up when I see they're like posters on growth mindset and emotional literacy. But, you know, that's a huge part, I think, of why this is so difficult, because we haven't really given anyone the tools for emotional literacy, and we particularly haven't expected or nurtured that in men. And I think that's like a really, really, really interesting piece of the puzzle as well.
I find it fascinating too, because my husband is exceptional, but when we do run into little things where maybe he's unconsciously expected it of me or thought it was on me without even realizing, sometimes I'm like, are you to blame, or is 35 years of conditioning to blame? Because you're good and you care about me and you do a lot of the thinking in this family. So is the fact that you thought I was responsible for that because you're an asshole, or is it because of conditioning? And he's not an asshole. So then am I angry at you, or am I angry at the system? So it's really interesting the way you move through it. I unfortunately have to jump off because I have to go to the pelvic health physio talking about the mental load for the women. So I have one more question for you. And that is, if you could give new mum Ellen one piece of advice about how she would navigate career and motherhood, what would it be?
Oh, I think it's just to remember that you have like 30 to 40 years of your career left. And so everything kind of becomes less urgent when you kind of take the long game. And I really wanted to acknowledge you, because we were meant to record in December and you sent me an email saying, I'm about to have a baby and I have overcommitted. And we should all be doing that more. And so, like, well done. That was really great role modeling. And you helped me.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for your kind response, because you responded so kindly and I didn't expect anything else, but it reinforced that I made the right decision at the time for me.
Yeah. And you helped me too, because I was like, I think I'm too busy as well.
We're all too bloody busy, especially in December.
Once I cancelled this meeting with this lovely white guy in his 60s, because like some kid stuff, and he wrote to me and it was the nicest email I've ever got. And he said, that's okay, Ellen. You can do anything, but you can't do everything.
Oh, that's a great way to end the show. Ellen, if people want to find you online, where should they go?
Yes, please come and connect on LinkedIn. Like, I know some people think that's weird, but I'm really happy to connect. Obviously, I'm Ellen Hooper there. And then on Instagram at ellen.hooper.consulting.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights and your story.
No worries.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.